today I am with my brother. His name is Jason. He's my oldest brother, and he's awesome. And we decided to record our interviews together and just lay it all out there and tell our stories. So thank you, Jason.
Hello. Thank you.
We should probably start back into our Pioneer history, because that's usually where everyone starts at. So do you want to tell everyone of our royal blood?
Yes. I was just listening to the last interview you did with Keith,
yes.
I think it was.
Yes.
And he said he didn't have any claim to fame. They were just, he just had ordinary ancestors. Well, not us. No, our Brigham Young is our fourth great uncle.
Right. His brother was Phineas Young, who was our grandfather. And Phineas was actually the person that introduced Brigham Young to Joseph Smith. So without Phineas, Brigham Young would never have been in the church.
That's right. So see, we have some important ancestry.
But nobody gives a crap.
Sure they do. Everyone's impressed.
All my life, I was like so proud. Oh, I'm related to Brigham Young. And then when the last year or so, when I learned who Brigham Young really was, my husband confessed that he always thought Brigham Young was a jerk and a bully, and he couldn't understand why I was so proud. And now I can realize, yeah, there's not much to be proud of.
Yeah. Our one claim to fame.
Yeah. Although he definitely was able to bring a large group of people to order, so I guess we should be proud of that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, no, he did a lot of amazing things.
Right. And then we also have another ancestor, Benjamin Mitchell, who was a master mason who built the Nauvoo Temple and the Salt Lake Temple, was very important and all that, and the St. George Temple.
Right. And I didn't know that until just a couple of years ago.
So there you go. We have a long lineage of LDS ancestry.
Yep. On both sides.
Yes.
Yep.
And we're doing Brigham proud.
Yeah. And our dad's family, that was all on our mom's side of the family. And our dad's side of the family had a lot of people come from England and come across the plains, and they were the early Mormons.
Okay, so that's the very beginning of time. And then both of our parents are raised in the church. Our mother probably more strongly than my father, our father, but definitely strong LDS background. All right, why don't you begin, since you were born first?
Okay, well, I'm the oldest of six. Katrine is the second. Katrine was born 5 years after I was. And then after that, in quick succession, our mom had three more, and then a surprise after that. So there's only one girl and five boys, and Katrine cried every time another boy was born.
This is really going to be embarrassing for me.
Maybe you don't want to do this.
Okay, but I'm very glad I have all my brothers. They're all really awesome people.
Well, it's a lot of priesthood, you know.
Yes. Yeah, I'm just lucky to be with all that power.
Right.
All right.
I would say the first few years of our lives were more normal than later, as far as our upbringing goes. Very active in the church, and I always got a sense that our dad was a little odd. He kind of embarrassed me from very early age, but it wasn't until I was about 13, 12, and that would have made you about 6, 7, when, looking back, things started to get a little bit strange. Other than the fact that we we had no money and our dad was running a little farm slash pet cemetery behind our house.
We should also say that we grew up in Utah Valley.
Right. Yes.
Very. Yes. Yeah. In rural Utah Valley.
Right. That's a pretty important part of our story, I would say. So our dad was eccentric. He's always been eccentric. And our mom was just very mild, very devout, but very non-confrontational also. And, overwhelmed. Really overwhelmed.
And then when do you think the craziness began? I was probably 12, 13? Or is that putting it too old?
I think you were a little bit younger. You just didn't quite realize it was happening yet. Let me preface this by saying that the church's teachings of personal revelation really laid the whole foundation for the next few years of insanity that existed in our family.
Right. We believed you could have personal revelation. You would be told by God what was beneficial to your life and what you should be doing. So it was never a doubt to us that we could receive revelation for ourselves.
Right. Yep. And that's how it all started. Dad started by saying that he was receiving personal revelation about his family and about his own church callings. And then he would tell us about those things. And sure, why wouldn't we believe those things? He was active in the church, always held callings, and he tried very hard to do what he was supposed to do. I know he did. He tried really hard. And at one point when you were about 11 and I was 5 years older than that, he started saying, he was called to be the stake mission president. And that was a really big thing for him. And it took a lot of his time and he was very proud of that and he worked very hard at that. And that's when the revelation started.
Right. And just to put that kind of in context, at the time it was a really big program where they would have members take pictures of themselves and write out their testimonies, and then we would rubber cement them into the Book of Mormons for the missionaries to pass out.
I remember rubber cementing pictures in the Book of Mormons.
Right. Yeah. So if you're from this time period, you remember those Book of Mormons and writing your testimony to be placed in Book of Mormons.
So most of his personal revelation wasn't any big deal yet, until he had been stake mission president for a while. And then it was revealed to him that he would soon be called to be a mission president in England, and that soon we would all be going to England. And that was very exciting, very new, very thrilling. And I know he was very proud of that, and mom was excited about that. They both served missions. They were very missionary work oriented. And so that was great. And of course for us, it was exciting because our dad was going to have this important calling and we were going to get to go to England and have this adventure.
And we never, growing up, we never left further than probably 15 minutes from our home.
Right.
Our life was very, very isolated because my dad had severe social anxiety, which meant that we didn't go anywhere. We never saw anything. We never traveled. We didn't leave a 30-mile radius at the largest, but usually it was like a 10-mile radius. We never went further. So to go to
right.
England on an airplane, are you kidding me?
Yeah, wow. So then a few, a year or two, I guess, went by, and he continued to have personal revelations, but nothing, he didn't tell us about anything really earth-shaking. And then he got tired of waiting to be called as a mission president, and he started to place the blame on the church leaders, starting with, I think, the local leaders. And then he started looking at the higher-ups in the church and placing blame on them. And he started talking about that. And then that's when it, like, all blew up, when he started getting revelations about what he would what he called the elect versus the apostates. And he spent a great deal of time categorizing people, everybody he knew around him, at work and at church and within the leadership of the church, the general authorities, and everybody he knew, he would categorize into either the elect, they were either elect or they were apostates. And so he preached that to us for quite a long time. I don't know if it was a few months or years.
And very few were safe from the apostate list.
That's right.
The apostate list was much larger than the elect. And usually apostate included wealthy people, mm-hmm. tall people, good-looking people.
Successful people. Outgoing people.
Yes.
Domineering people. Ambitious people.
The quieter you were, the more elect you were. The uglier you were, the more elect you were.
Right.
And nobody was safe, including family members.
That's right. Including family members. So he categorized everybody. So Katrine and I felt very, very lucky to be elect, which kind of makes me think, and wow, we must have been really ugly and socially backward.
But man, I felt special.
I know.
I was one of the chosen.
I don't know what we were supposed to do with all the information. I would except go to church, and I would go to church and look at all these people that Dad had said were elect and apostate, and just think, oh yeah, look at that person. That person's so outgoing, and that person is so vocal and assertive, and oh, they're evil. They're on Satan's side. So these people, the apostates, weren't just like evil people, but they were part of Satan's army in disguise. And they had infiltrated the church, and their sole purpose in life was to take us elect, take the elect down and ruin us, destroy us. That was the big battle that was going on before the end of times. And then it was kind of the icing on the cake with that whole elect versus apostate thing was, at the time, President Benson was the prophet. And President Benson was definitely an apostate, huge apostate. And actually, he evolved from apostate to, yeah, who? No one else but Lucifer.
Dun, dun, dun.
Ezra Taft Benson was actually Satan in disguise. So he had somehow gotten at the head of the Lord's church through all of his lying and manipulating and evil ways. And undoubtedly that Southern Idaho upbringing helped him with that. Oh wait, Dad was brought up in Southern Idaho as well. So we had a few months of Ezra Taft Benson is doing everything in his power to destroy the elect, and not just the elect, but the very most elect person of all, Dad. So it was revealed to Dad that he had to stay off the freeways because President Benson apparently had control of the freeways, the traffic. And
we laugh now, but at the time it was so serious.
It was very serious.
Our father could be killed, murdered for his electness, for his righteousness.
Murdered on the I-15 right off of the Lehigh exit. Anyway, so and then at that same time it was a really dry year in Utah, and there were a lot of brush fires, and we lived right at the foot of the Wasatch Mountains, and there were a lot of fires that we could see from our house. And it turns out that Ezra Taft Benson was lighting those fires. He was putting those fires there by his wicked, satanly power, and trying to scare Dad away. Was that what it was? Scare Dad into being quiet?
Yeah, I don't know.
Destroy him? I don't know exactly what.
Yeah, burn him out. But since President Benson was Lucifer himself, and Dad was this righteous man who Lucifer was after, that would mean, in, you know, process of elimination, that Dad was actually the true prophet of the church, and someday his power would be restored and he would take his proper place among the Mormon people as prophet, seer, and revelator.
Right. Yes. Yeah, Ezra Taft Benson needed to take him out, get him out of the way so he wouldn't take his spot. After that, Dad's role continued to evolve, and he started talking a lot. He kind of continued on the point of the characteristics of the elect and the characteristics of Jesus Christ himself, and how in the church he is always portrayed as a strong, tall, handsome individual, as you see in all the paints. When in reality, he wasn't. He was not. He was meek. He was humble. He was diminutive. He was small and short. And in fact, he actually kind of looked a lot like Dad. And so...
What a coincidence!
And so that set the stage for Dad revealing to us that, and I don't remember when he actually came out with this, but actually revealing to us that it had been revealed to him that he is actually not just the rightful prophet of the church, but he was indeed even Jesus Christ, our Savior.
And you believed it all.
I did.
And so did I.
All, and so did you, and so did Mom.
Yes.
We all did. The three of us did, and we lived for a while in our own strange little existence.
If you've seen the movie The Beautiful Mind, when for a while you don't realize he's living in this fantasy world, and then when the realization comes that it's all been delusional fog, we were living in that fantasy world. And by that fantasy world, it was every night, hours and hours of talking about Dad's revelations. Dad wrote journals after journals after journal of his writings, of his revelations. He was retranslating the Book of Mormon. He became obsessed with the Second Coming. That was always talked about.
Huge.
So this took over our life. This was... go to school and then learn about Dad's revelations. That was about it. And do you want to talk about your multiple mothers?
Oh, well, I think it kind of simultaneously developed slowly throughout this time that Dad, it was revealed to Dad that he actually had multiple wives, and that he was a polygamist, because that's the way, you know, that's the new and everlasting covenant, and that's the way it was supposed to be. So he started having it revealed to him that he had all of these additional wives living around him. It started with one special woman who was much, much younger than he was. And she was a return missionary, and she worked with him when he was state mission president in that capacity. And she's a sweet, wonderful person.
Let's give her a pseudonym. What should we call her?
Zsa Zsa.
Zsa Zsa.
Okay. No.
Dad became obsessed with Zsa Zsa.
No, she's not a Zsa Zsa type.
No, she wasn't.
She was really more like a Judith type, or a...
Oh, she's prettier than a Judith. She was a... Susan.
Susan type. I guess she could have been a Susan type. Yes, Susan. We'll call her Susan.
No, let's go with Zsa Zsa. It's more fun.
Zsa Zsa?
Yeah.
Zsa Zsa. So it was revealed to Dad that Zsa Zsa was his next wife. And so he started taking a huge interest in her above and beyond what was happening in his calling as state commission president.
And she was in our ward, so he had access to her.
Yes. We saw her all the time. She lived just a couple blocks away. And he really kind of started stalking her. Not kind of. He did. He stalked her. I don't know if she ever really knew that he was actually following her around and parking in front of her house at night or standing in our backyard and gazing toward their house.
Which he couldn't even see from our house, but he would look.
But he could just look up there. And every night he would drive. He would take a little drive.
Yeah, he'd drive by our house every night. And he believed that if the lights were on, that meant she was thinking about him. But if the lights were off, that meant that her evil mother was in the house and she couldn't spend time to communicate spiritually with him at the time. So they had a system.
Yes. Yes. And this mother was very, very much an apostate. Ooh, she was like the queen of apostates. So anyway, so he followed Zsa Zsa around, and then I guess he got tired of that. And so she always was his favorite, I think. But then he started getting revelations that there were others. And it was very convenient that they just happened to be others that were just around him in his life. Somebody else at church, somebody else that worked with him in the state mission capacity.
The librarian,
the librarian was the same one. She was also a state missionary.
Oh, well, her father was one of Dad's counselors.
Right. And then she was called to be a state missionary too. And she was a librarian, which was convenient because the library was very close to where Dad was. I don't know, was he working there at the time? Anyway, it was close.
No, but it was within that safe 10-mile radius of our home.
Oh, right. It was very convenient in that, yeah. Anyway, it was right in our little town. So he started kind of talking her well, and he even used Katrine as, what?
As his decoy?
As bait?
Suddenly, my dad paid attention to me, which he didn't do often. Oh, let's go to the library. Well, okay. So we go to the library, and while I'm picking up LDS fiction like Charlie, Dad would be flirting with the librarian. And we'd probably go twice a week. It's the most time I've ever spent with Dad is when he was on the prey for a wife.
Yep.
But I don't think I knew at the time that he thought he was married to her.
No, I don't think so. That came later. And I don't know if she ever really knew what was going on either. I think she kind of... I bet both she and Zsa Zsa felt uncomfortable. Not really sure, though, exactly what was going on. But anyway, and then the list continued. And it got, I don't know how long. And I don't really even remember too many of the other... people who were on the list of his wives.
I don't really know who they were, but there was probably seven to eight women on there, I would think. Because I saw the list once, and it was less than 10, I think.
I think after that, it got longer, but...
Possibly.
That was kind of later on. And Mom knew all about it. He told her about it. And, I mean, I guess that's good. He was honest with her. He talked to her constantly about all of these things that were going on. Lots and lots of discussions overheard. And she just kind of accepted it, kind of went along with it. I don't know if it made her feel bad or if she just truly thought, well, yeah, this is the way. This is the new and everlasting covenant. This is the way it's going to be.
Yep, she definitely believed in the priesthood head. And it was also part of Mom's personality where she didn't confront people. She didn't like contention. Was meek and mild and never heard her say an unkind thing about anyone. So thinking something that she would feel unkind about her husband was just not in her capacity.
No, it really wasn't. Just wasn't her. Dad also had me convinced that I was to be a very, very important prophet, a very key player in ushering in the millennium. And he even had me convinced that I was going to be, in the New Testament it talks about a prophet shall be raised up or something who will bring in the millennium, and then it talks about a couple prophets that'll lay dead in the streets for a while, and then Christ will return. Can't quite remember what it says, but talked about that. And he had me convinced that that was me. I was going to be, that was me. Dad was preparing me to do that, to bring in the second coming. So, wow. Talk about
self-righteous.
Yes, I was really important. And you know what? All of this felt right. I don't think we mentioned that. I mean, we mentioned that we believed it all, but I didn't just accept it. I mean, I followed the counsel of Moroni and I prayed about it and I fasted about it and thought about it. And every single time I would get that warm, warm feeling inside. In spite of the fact that there were little alarms going off in my head that I was refusing to listen to, my heart and the inside of me was feeling, oh, this is true. This is right. And so, you know, to me, that was my confirmation, when really I think that was just me feeling really, really good that I was going to be important and useful and that I was going to be so key in
a church
of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, a church we loved, a church we believed in, a church we're devoted to. Why wouldn't we be important in it?
Right. And then I carried that that aura around me, kind of. I don't know if I said much. I know I had one friend, my best friend, that I talked to about it. And he actually believed me.
Did you tell him about Dad's revelations?
I didn't go into detail about it because I know he wouldn't go for that. The whole Ezra Taft Benson thing, he would be like, no way. He wouldn't have bought that. But or the wives thing.
Yeah.
He would have fallen for that. But I did tell him about how I was going to be very important in ushering in the second coming. And he believed that. And it was called Jason's Special Purpose. I had a quote.
You had a title?
Well, we didn't say, hey, let's call this Jason's Special Purpose.
Oh, you had a
but
title.
But whenever we talked about it, that's just kind of how it came up. Well, you know, your special purpose. Yes, my special purpose.
About the same time, we mentioned that Dad became obsessed with the second coming. It was something he discussed all the time. One time I remember we were out in the garden and you mentioned the fires that were happening. And Dad was hoeing in the garden. I'm standing next to him and he says, look at that sun. And it was blood red. And he said, blood red sun is a sign of the second coming. And I thought, oh, well, I actually think that's from the smoke, from the fire. But then I quickly rationalized it. Oh, but that's just how God made the sun red. He caused the fire to make the sun blood red so we would see the sign.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember all the signs. I know there were a lot, and I don't think he even made them up. I think they were in Mormon culture and teachings.
Yeah. Right. He would just point those out, that a lot of things have already happened. So many things are falling in place in order for the second coming to happen. Another one I remember was one of the, I don't even know where it is, but one of the early prophets, it could have been Joseph Smith. No, it wasn't Joseph Smith. It was a prophecy about Salt Lake City, but that before the second coming, the streets of Salt Lake City would flow in blood, would be like rivers of blood. Blood would just flow freely down the streets of Salt Lake City before the return of Christ. And at some point during those years, there was actually a big flood, and the streets of Salt Lake City were turned into rivers. A lot of the main streets around Temple Square and downtown Salt Lake were sandbagged, and they were not able to use them as roads because there was so much flooding going on, and they were rivers, some of those streets. And so that, of course, was a fulfillment of another sign. It wasn't blood, but the water is a symbol. As we know, water is a symbol for blood. So that was just another one that we could check off our list of things that needed to happen.
And this was horrific for me. I mentioned I was a scared child. Yeah. This scared the living life out of me. I was, even though Dad told me I was elect and I was going to be saved and be, you know, transfigured, it still scared me so much that people were going to die, people were going to burn. And Dad would always say it with such glee, oh, the apostate are all going to be burned at the stake. There'll be rivers of blood. And just so happy about it. And I'm like, ah, great.
I know. I mean, if you read the book of Revelations, it's just this big, huge nightmare. And I was afraid, too. I was really afraid, even though, you know, I was like the most important prophet that ever, I was going to be the most important prophet that ever existed in the whole world. I was still afraid of all of those awful things that were in the book of Revelation.
And then Dad comes up with a date. The date of the second coming.
Yes, yes. Before he did that, though, I graduated from high school, and I went to USU in Logan, and I was there for one quarter, and during that quarter was when most of all of the second coming stuff sort of came to a head, and that was when he came up with that date of when the second coming was supposed to happen.
And do you remember the date? I remember as December 1st. Is that what you remember?
That's a good
question. I know it was December.
I know. Well, it was right after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So that could have been, because I had just been home for Thanksgiving break. And while we were there, while I was there, of course, Dad talked a lot to us about when it was going to happen. And so, yeah, I'm sure it was December 1st, if that's what you remember, that it being in December. It's just a late Thanksgiving break, I guess. It was probably Monday, December 1st, right after Thanksgiving break. Because, oh, well, I'll get to that in a second. Oh, I remember over that Thanksgiving break, him talking a lot to us about how time is slowly coming to a stop. And he said he could feel time slowing way down. One night, I think it was the night, like Saturday night, after Thanksgiving, that for some reason we were standing around the piano. He said, can you feel that? This evening, it was like 10 o'clock at night, he said, this evening has gone on for hours and days. This evening has lasted so long. That's because time is coming to a halt. And once it actually stops, that's when the second coming will begin. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but I remember he also told me, he's like, I want you to pay attention to your body because the transfiguration process has begun. The elect are starting to be transfigured. And so if you feel pain, you'll know that you're starting to begin to be transfigured. And I took that seriously. And I remember once in my bedroom, I got this huge pain in my back. I don't know where it came from. It could have been made up by now in my own head. I don't know. But I got a pain in my back. It was real. It was physical. And I was like, oh, it's happening. I am being transfigured because I am elect. The second coming is on its way.
Wow. I don't remember that part.
Oh, you don't? I don't know if I told you. But yeah, I took it seriously. I was a believer.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
We should also mention that sadly, oh, there was also another group out. There was elect, apostate, and there was the telestial or terrestrial. Telestials. And sadly, one of our brothers was a telestial and one of them was an apostate. So not even our family members were safe in this process.
No. I wonder if they listen to this, if they'll all be able to figure out who was who.
I don't know. I'm not ever saying. They can probably guess, but I'm not ever telling them.
I know. Can you imagine? So we spent Thanksgiving break kind of mourning for these two, who one of them was apostate, so I guess he was going to burn in hell, I suppose.
Oddly enough, it didn't bother Dad at all.
I know. And then the other one, if you're telestial, then you just, it's like going to the telestial kingdom.
You go to Lagoon instead of Disneyland, you know.
Yeah, right. So we weren't too worried about him. We kind of grieved. We mourned the loss. Especially Mom and Dad, I remember. Well, not Dad.
Mom.
Mom mourning the loss, being sad that, you know, she was about to lose one of her sons, and that's just the way it was, because it was bad. Can you imagine?
That's depressing.
So awful. And I had finals coming up on December 1st.
It doesn't matter!
The week of December 1st, I had finals, and I have always been a very good student. Very good student. And so for me to blow off finals had to be like a huge thing, like maybe Armageddon. So I knew Armageddon was on its way. So I'm like, oh, I'm not going to study. Why should I? Just spend time with my family, my little brother who's going to burn in hell. So I didn't study. All right. So shall we go to that particular evening? December 1st.
Sure. Yeah, you ended up going to Logan. You debated about whether you should go or not.
Right. I didn't have a car, so I kind of depended on other people that went to school up there for rides and stuff. So I think my ride was leaving, and I didn't know if I should just stay home or if there was a part of me that kind of like thought, well, just in case it doesn't happen, maybe I should just go on with my life. I don't know. So anyway, I ended up leaving, went back to Logan, and that night, it was impossible to sleep. Dad had told us that sometime during the night, somebody from our family, a special somebody from our family would come, who had died, would come and pick us up, come and take us away up into heaven, and in the twinkling of an eye. And so that was my grandpa. But you think it was my grandma?
I thought it was grandma, but right? Which would be our mom's mother.
Yeah, which it could have been, because I always had, even though I never knew her, she died before I was born. No, she died while our mom was pregnant with me. I like always had this really close feeling with her. Like I was kind of a Saturday's Warrior kind of thing where, you know, I remember from the pre-existence and we had this special bond and this special relationship. And I had this memory of her walking me through heaven to the edge of heaven.
right pushed you off.
Right before I was born.
Like, see, pushing push.
Down into mom's womb. Right before I was born. I don't know. And I always thought that, I mean, that was such a nice thought in my brain. And of course, the spirit confirmed to me that that was true because I prayed about it. And so, I guess it was her probably thinking about it. She was the one who was going to come and retrieve me in the twinkling of an eye. And so I lay there in my bed waiting for her to come and do that all night long. Next to my roommate who was snoring.
You're waiting for him to burn.
I know, yeah, because he was an apostate. He drove me mad. And it didn't happen. No one came. And along about 4 or 5 in the morning, I started to panic because I hadn't studied for my finals.
I thought you were going to say you panicked because you thought maybe you were an apostate after all and they were leaving you behind.
Oh, no.
But no, you had English coming up.
So I waited till about 6 in the morning and then I called Dad long distance. Didn't do that much because it cost so much, you know, back then. And he very quietly answered the phone and I said, "So what's going on?" "Well, I'm not quite sure, but the Lord, I think, is trying to just test us. This is another test to make sure we're truly faithful. And it could still happen sometime today. So just watch and wait and be aware and pray." And it's like, okay. All right, well, gotta go. Gotta go study. And strangely enough, I did very well on those finals.
You were blessed.
It must have been.
Well, I remember I was home, so the night before, Dad was so excited. He was just giddy with the anticipation of blood running down the streets. And I was just scared. I was very fearful. And I went to bed that night and I thought, well, I'll never sleep. But surprisingly enough, I did go to sleep and I slept all night long. And then about 6 in the morning, my bedroom door opens and I can only see the silhouette of Dad. And he was so depressed, just upset and beside himself. And I said, "Well, what happened, Dad?" And he said, "Well, not even God can control time." And instantly I thought, what? God can't control time? What? And I didn't say it to him, but I was just like, that makes no sense. And then he said, "If you want, you can stay home with us and wait. You don't have to go to school." Well, Jason knows that I hated school. I would do anything to get out of school. But immediately I was like, no, I'm out of here. I'm out of this situation. And I got up and I went to school. And it became from Dad being elect and being prophet or Christ or whatever you wanted to call him to Satan has my dad. Satan has control of my father. I truly believe that Dad was a righteous man, and I'd been taught all my life that Satan's after the most righteous of us, and he had gotten his grips onto Dad. And I became just so set against Satan that I would do anything to cast him out of Dad. So, we laugh about it now, but it was very, very upsetting. It was very,
yeah,
very sad.
Right. Very traumatic. And not once did it ever occur to either of us that, wait a minute, maybe Dad's just crazy.
Well, I didn't even know what mental illness really was. I can't even explain to people how isolated our world was. There was no internet. We had very few books. We didn't leave a 10-mile radius. We lived in Mormon Valley, where you were taught Mormon in school and at church. I mean, there was just no outside views to gain knowledge from.
Right. Very sheltered. Very strange upbringing. Strange existence. Yeah, no, we didn't know. No, I didn't ever think Dad was crazy. Didn't think he was mentally ill. I didn't even, never crossed my mind. And like you, I didn't really understand it either that well. I mean, I heard terms thrown around on TV once in a while, but I had no idea what that was. So yeah, I kind of had that idea too, that Dad was deceived. He was being led astray, and that we needed to get back on track. So that's when I decided, okay, well, I'm just going to go on my mission. I had waited because I wasn't quite 19. I turned 19 the month after the second coming was supposed to happen. And so I just decided just to go on my mission, even though, you know, the church was led by Satan and all of that. I still hadn't ruled out all of Dad's teachings. They were so embedded in me that I didn't rule them out, but I just decided, well, I need to go on my mission, because that's part of my life's plan, and I've always wanted to go, and
so that's what to do.
Right. So I did. I got ready to go, and I was called, and I left in April. But during those 4 months, 3 or 4 months, a lot of transitioning kind of went on in my head, because I realized, well, I'm going to go on this mission, and I'm going to teach the church's teachings, then I need to figure out what do I believe, and I need to weed out all of this stuff that Dad had planted in our heads over the years. So I was in the process of doing that, but he would continued on loud and proud, even more vocal than before about his beliefs. And in church meetings, he once in a while would say something over the years that I could tell was off and not in accordance with what everybody else believed. And I could see people feeling a little uncomfortable, but no one ever said anything. And then it really stood out when I came home from USU and I was getting ready for my mission and go to church, and I'd see him saying all these things, and I'd be like, oh, stop it. Sit down. Don't talk. Blah. And there were times that I would go to priesthood meeting with him for Sunday school, and mom had a calling that she must have been in Primary Relief Society or something at that time. So she wasn't ever in the meetings with us, but I would just get up and walk out. He would start going off on some tangent about something that I knew wasn't in line with the church, and it would just mortify me. So I would just get up and leave in the middle of his sentences. That was hard. That was a really hard time. And then it was time for my missionary farewell, and It was a nice farewell, and I had a lot of friends there and other family members, and it was great. And I had developed much better relationships by that point in time with the ward members, so I felt better about that. But Dad gave a talk, of course, as they did back then. They don't do that anymore, right?
No, they don't.
They don't. Only like the bishop will say something.
The missionary will talk, and whoever other speaker they have, and it's not a mission based on him leaving, it's just a normal talk.
Okay. Yeah, so, but back then it was a big to-do.
Yeah, it was a whole sacrament meeting.
Just for you. And so, Dad gave a talk, and he of course was saying strange things, and nothing too wild or outlandish. And then, in the middle of it, and then he gets this really strange prophetic voice, maybe, and he says, I hesitate to do this, but I fear what would happen if I did not do this, so I am going to call down on the powers of heaven to bless my son, but I am going to give him this blessing. And then he, like, lifted his arms up in the air over the congregation, and he goes, and then he says, I bless you, my son, that you will blah, 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 and I don't remember exactly what he said, but he went on, like, saying some pretty strange things and doing this practice that is completely not within the norms of what is done in sacrament meetings. And I just wanted to just shrink in my seat and disappear.
And I felt hot, and I swear my face was red, and I was looking down, and I just was like, I can't look, I can't look. And then I glance up, and people were just like staring at Dad with eyes wide, and I was like, oh, oh, this is bad, this is bad.
Yep.
And Mom sat there smiling proudly.
And did anybody ever say, anyone from the ward ever say anything to you about any of how strange or off it was?
Not a soul, and neither did any of his siblings.
Yeah, and they were all active.
Yep. Like, no one said anything.
Nobody said a word. None of my friends either said anything about it. Maybe my best friend did. Maybe he mentioned something. No, I don't think he did. He just wasn't, I think in a way it was way bigger in our heads than what it really was.
Maybe, but it was still weird. I mean,
people just, maybe they were just trying to be polite and didn't want to make us feel bad, or maybe they just long since accepted that Dad was just eccentric and that's just the way he was. And,
I don't know.
Wasn't hurting anything, but awkward. So, during that time, I was going to ask you, during that time, what were you thinking and feeling? But I remember we talked before I went on my mission. We had some very definite words about getting Dad to stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's something you have to understand about our dad. He's very meek and mild. He is not confrontational. He's easy to put in his place. He's just timid.
Except I was still afraid to.
Were you?
Because growing up, whenever he perceived that I was quote unquote questioning his authority, he would get really mad. Really mad.
Yeah. He did do that.
So, he never did that with anybody else, ever.
I had a few run-ins with him.
No, I mean, other than us.
Oh, yeah.
Other than his kids.
Yeah.
And I know that if Mom had ever said anything, could have said something back to her about it, too, for sure. But there were a few times that I would, like, question him on stuff, and he would just be furious about it. Slam his hand down on the table and just get really mad. So I was a little bit afraid of confronting him and telling him to stop it. But on the other hand, I knew we needed to say it because we had these four little brothers who were coming up, and they so far had not been involved in this at all. They knew nothing about it. One of our brothers had bits and pieces that he had gathered. So anyway, so we sat down with him, and we said, I told him I'm about to go on my mission, and we've got these four sons here that you need to not tell all of this stuff to, because it's very confusing, it's scary, it's harmful, you need to stop. You need to keep your thoughts to yourself.
Well, I think you even phrased it, don't ever talk about this again. To me or Katrine, just do not talk about it, ever.
Yeah, right.
He pretty much did after that. But you go on your mission, and he pretty much stopped talking about it, but I knew stuff was going on. I still saw the journals. I saw him whispering with Mom. There was still things going on, and I became so hyper-vigilant, like, I am going to get Satan out of our lives. Satan is after our righteous family, and The fear was great because I've been taught my entire life that if everyone in the family didn't do what they were supposed to do, then we would not be together for eternity. So I saw his dad not doing what he's supposed to do, so we're all just going to be scattered and not be together. So it was very scary for me. And I started telling people. I told a seminary teacher, I told a counselor at school, and I told one of our bishops. And pretty much told them a great deal about it, and nobody ever did a dang thing.
What did the bishop say to you when you told him all this?
He listened to the story, and I felt he believed me. He said, well, I'll have to watch out for this or something. And there was one, I had told him that Dad did this thing where if he believed that the person blessing the sacrament was apostate, he would pray for the sacrament. He would say the sacrament prayer. And I remember once Dad was saying the prayer along with whoever was saying it, and the bishop was like leaning his neck around the pulpit so he could see us. And I felt like saying, see, I am not making this crap up. Like, he was doing this. But nobody ever checked on me. No one ever asked me how I was doing. No one ever mentioned that there may be a mental illness, which makes me wonder, did they not know? Did they not want to discuss it with me? Do they think that Satan was in our home? I have no idea. But it also made me realize that the bishop doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, he was a good man, but he did not know what was going on.
Of course not. Clearly, most of Dad's teachings and beliefs were so way out there in contrast to the mainstream teachings of the church that, I mean, shouldn't he have been excommunicated for all of that? I mean, it's not like he had these beliefs and he wasn't being quiet about it, talking to people about it.
Actually, I don't believe his teachings were really all that out there. I just think the difference was that it was all grandiose for Dad. Like, it was, Dad was the savior of it all. Dad knew what was happening with everything. Dad had full knowledge and no one else did. So that's the only thing that was different. But these weird beliefs, Dad didn't really make them up. They were there to begin with. He didn't make up polygamy. He didn't make up the second coming or the signs. Right. He just made it about himself.
Right. That's true. Yeah. The church gave him the foundation and he just took it and ran. But I don't know. The stuff about, like, President Benson being Satan and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he could have gotten in trouble. And no one, not that I wanted him to get in trouble, but any bishop wanted to get him in trouble because he was just this little man who had goats and burned his garbage in the backyard. Strange man. But I never said anything to anybody about it, any church leaders. It never crossed my mind. It never crossed my mind to get help.
Well, I did while you were gone, and then I was like, well, I didn't do any good.
Right. Because no one knew. And if anything had been done, you probably would have just been referred to LDS Social Services.
I suppose.
That's probably what you would have been. And you know, I don't know if they would have tried to get Dad to go or anything like that, but you were clearly the one who had the problem.
Yeah. It was about me.
Yeah.
So then you're on your mission. You served a successful 2-year mission.
Yes.
You're at Utah State. And I fell a year later after graduation to come to school there. And pretty much just everything's pretty uneventful for a while.
Right. He's quiet. He's not saying stuff. I think he's overwhelmed with his work situation. He was laid off and then spent all his retirement on a flower shop. And so then all of his time and energy went into the flower shop with Mom. They both just put their whole lives into that flower shop. And that, of course, was, well, the weird stuff was still going on because remember he would like take those long quote-unquote flower deliveries to places.
I don't know.
We didn't know about.
I don't know.
We didn't really know.
I didn't ask.
And we didn't want to know. I mean, there were things that I'd be like, there we go. But we certainly didn't want to know, so we didn't say anything. But their flower shop business did not do well, all because, not because they aren't business people. They were not business people. They didn't have the first clue about how to run a business. There was plenty of business to be had. It was in a great location. It was a cute little shop. But, and there weren't many other places like that around, but they just couldn't do it. They didn't do it well. And then part of the reason why the business failed too was at some point our mom started getting really, really bad leg pains. And she thought it was just because she was standing all the time arranging flowers on her feet all the time in the shop. And she lived with that pain for I don't know how long. And then she finally went to the doctor, and that's when they found out that her body was already riddled with cancer.
It was everywhere.
It was in her bones. She had a huge 9-inch tumor in her abdomen. It was in her lymph nodes. Her breasts, it was breast cancer, but her breasts were like hard, weren't they?
I don't know if they were. About. I don't know if they were hard, but the tumors were all through her breasts.
Yeah. So I think I remember somebody saying, maybe she said it, that they were just hard because of that. I never touched them myself.
Neither did I.
No. So that kind of, I think, put everything on a everything came to a screeching halt. For Dad, in a lot of ways. I think he didn't have time to imagine or think about all the things that he used to think about. And, you know, it just consumed him for the next couple of years.
And they started chemo for Mom. There were times where they did not think things through clearly, and there was, Dad didn't make good decisions considering her treatment, but I don't even know if that would have helped. The cancer was really, really, it'd been there a long time. And she suffered with that for 2 years. And then on, Christmas Eve, 1996, we all, my brother, actually the brother younger than me, came home early from his mission. He was supposed to come home on Christmas Eve, but he came home a month early because time was short. And Christmas Eve, we gathered around my mom's bed and we told her she could go. And she did Christmas morning.
She held on until every single one of her kids was there. I was the last one to get there. I was in California, and I drove up a couple days before us, and we were all there, and that's when she quit eating and quit drinking anything, and she had long since been gone mentally.
Yeah. I was living in Texas, and I came home on my birthday, which is December 21st, and she said her very last words to me that day, and I never heard her say another word. I don't think anybody else did ever again.
So, yeah, that was our Christmas that year. Very strange. I remember sitting in the living room Christmas morning, and I had my tears there. One was 3, one was 7. No, actually the 7-year-old wasn't there. Just the 3-year-old was there. And she, of course, was all excited. She knew Grandma had died, but she was all excited because it was Christmas. And so we sat in the living room and opened presents while Mom was in the bedroom, laying there, dead. Had you gotten there yet?
You called me, like, 5 or 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I wasn't there for that part, but I came not early in the morning. Left my kids at my in-laws.
Yeah. Yep. So, I think the most sad and frustrating thing about all of that was that, well, two things about, so many things about her death were sad and frustrating, but first of all, the year before she was actually diagnosed, she had had a mammogram, and there was an irregularity on it, and they called them and told them that something had shown up on the mammogram, and that they wanted her to come in again, and she didn't go in. They didn't do anything about it.
Because whoever told him the mammogram said that it's probably not anything, but you'll probably want to get it checked out. And mom and dad, I call them the king and queen of denial. And because they were worried about money, I'm sure, thought, oh, it's probably nothing. We'll go with that. She caught it early. She had found the lump. She had caught it early. And they did nothing about it.
So she went in for the mammogram because she found a lump?
Yeah, she found a lump. The month I got married, she found a lump. And she went and got a mammogram.
I didn't remember that.
Yep. And said, oh, it's probably nothing. And then it grew for 2 years.
And then the other thing that is just so tragic about this was that she, well, besides the fact that our youngest brother was 11, and she had a house full of teenage boys that she left behind, was that she never really, aside from having her children, which that was her whole existence and her pride and joy, she never ever got to live life in a way that brought her happiness. She never got to do things that she was interested in doing. Dad never let her. She never had time because of the kids, which, you know, happens a lot, but even if it weren't for that, she still wouldn't have been able to go and just do anything that she was interested in because Dad shut her down constantly.
She couldn't even go to a movie. If she wanted to call her sisters, it was a big ordeal because my dad felt that they couldn't afford it. It was too expensive to call. So she didn't call any of her family, and it was only, 15 miles away?
Yeah. And she didn't ever communicate with any of them, rarely, because Dad always told her it was too expensive to call or to drive there.
Mom never stood up for herself. You never question your priesthood head, and she just never stood up for herself, and it was just tragic, and Dad wanted his life really small, because the smaller it is, the less people you have interfering with your own thoughts. He wanted to live with his mental illness, and to bring in anything else was too much for him. So she missed out on a lot.
Yeah, he was pretty successful at doing that, I'd say, for a long time.
And there was a small part, though, at the end there, when she was sick, I saw a part of her where she's like, I'm done with this. I'm going to do what I want. And she did a few things that was like, Mom! Whoa, yeah. I didn't know you had it in you. And it was like going to a movie. Or she went and saw you in California.
Yeah. I mean,
amazing stuff.
Yeah.
That she never had done before.
Right.
And she left Dad to do it.
Yep. And he was not happy about it.
No.
But she did. And when she came to visit me in California, I saw that too, which was just, I had never seen her like that. And I never saw her like that again. But she was like, I'm going to learn how to swim. And she brought a swimming suit. And I had never seen her in a swimming suit.
And do you remember she bought it at DI. And my mom was ultra, ultra modest. Very modest. And she felt that the swimsuit was too low in front. And so she added this panel to her swimsuit to cover up her chest some more so you couldn't see anything.
Right.
And then she wore a t-shirt over it. But you have a really cute picture of her in her swimsuit with a cover-up.
Yeah.
And then she had a bandana around her head. Very cute photo of her.
Yeah. And she never took the cover-up off.
So she didn't even need the panel after all.
No. And I remember during that time, it was in the middle of the summer, and we were obviously at the pool, and our little girls were there with us, and there was a group of my neighbors, in the jacuzzi, and they were drinking champagne, which they weren't supposed to be doing in the common area. But they were drinking champagne with strawberries in it, and they had obviously had a fair amount of champagne, and they were having a very happy time, getting a little wild and boisterous, and Mom just kept glancing over there, just like so nervous, and she didn't know what to do. And she'd like look at me, but she wouldn't say anything. And it occurred to me that she had never, that was probably the first time she had ever been in the presence of anybody at any kind of a close distance drinking alcohol. She had probably never even seen alcohol in her life.
Probably not.
So that's the first time she'd probably ever seen it, like, other than on TV. Because you couldn't go to the store and see it. And my youngest daughter decided that she needed to go to the bathroom, so I walked her over to the bathroom, which was right by the jacuzzi, and on the way back out, one of the ladies pulled the strawberry out of her champagne glass and said, "Do you want a strawberry? Oh, you're so cute. Do you want a strawberry?" My youngest daughter said, "Oh, thank you." And Mom saw that whole thing go down. And again, she was just like mortified that I had let Amelia eat a strawberry that had been in champagne. She never said anything about it, but I could tell that's what she was thinking. She was like looking at it, just like very uneasy, not judgmental really, but just like so uneasy. That was before I had left the church. So yeah, even that was pretty liberal though, wasn't it?
I'm surprised you let her eat the strawberry.
Yeah, me too. I didn't want to make the neighbors feel bad. No, it wasn't that. I was too scared to say anything. I was also very afraid of confrontation as well.
So Mom passes away. Devastating. I saw little bits of Dad's unique personality come out during the funeral and everything that happened with that. He wanted to call everybody he ever knew until Mom had died, and it became very uncomfortable because some of these people didn't even know Mom was sick. Some of these people hadn't talked to Dad in years, and yet Dad was calling them and telling them all about it, and it was more like, yeah, my wife died, and now I'm on my own, and now I'm going to take care of these kids, and now it was all about him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just phone call after phone call, and it was just becoming, it was hard to hear because it was just so much, and it was, I can't even tell you how long he'd been on that phone.
Yeah.
So that was not the norm.
Right. The whole sickness was about how much he suffered.
Yeah.
Which of course he had greatly.
Oh yeah.
But, you know, usually when you lose somebody and or you have somebody who is in a lot of pain and coming close to death, you think about them, right? You talk about how much they're suffering and how hard it is for them. But he didn't really ever acknowledge that. It was all a very big hardship for him.
Yeah. And then again at the funeral when he talked, the whole talk was pretty much about him. I mean, he said some nice things about Mom too, but it was about how he still had great work to do. His time wasn't over. He was still had a great purpose in life.
Yep, that was tough. But none of us really said anything to him about it, did you? I mean, what do you say to a man who just lost his wife? But
I was exhausted. I just didn't want to pay attention to him.
No. Nobody did.
Yeah.
No one wanted to.
And then I knew all along that Dad was going to remarry. I knew he couldn't take care of himself. You know, He wasn't of that generation where you could be single by yourself. So he started dating a few women and set his eyes on one, sights on one, and got married 11 months after he met her. Or 11 months after Mom died, sorry. I don't know how long he knew her.
He'd known her before a little bit, I think, but...
And even that was just... Like, he told me he was getting married. He didn't tell me when. I came from Texas for Christmas. Or it was Thanksgiving, I think. I came for Thanksgiving and found out he was going to get married while I was there. Never met her. And then he doesn't tell me when or where or what time. And I ran into a neighbor at the movie theater. And she's like, oh, it's so great. Your dad's getting remarried. I'm so excited. And she said, I'll see you there. And I said, okay, when is it? All right, when is it? Where is it going to be? I didn't even know.
Yeah.
And the boys were upset.
Yeah. I didn't know either. And yeah, the boys were upset and the boys did not like her at all.
No, didn't like her. She had her own set of problems. And Dad never asked them how they felt or how they were responding. Our youngest brother was 13 at the time. And his plan was to marry this woman. And they were going to live in her apartment for a few months. And Dad never even gave a second thought to what the 13-year-old would be doing or living. He just left. And I was furiated that he would just leave his son. And people in the ward, I do want to go back and say the people in our church and our ward had been very kind to Mom and had done a lot of nice things and taken care of our brothers for Christmas and were very generous. Mm-hmm. And I will always be grateful for how kind they were. And enough can't be said that, like, they made sure my brothers had Christmas presents and they made sure that arrangements had been made and they would sit with Mom. So they were very kind. But here comes this daughter and she's upset because her father's getting married, which I really wasn't. I was mad that she was leaving, he was leaving his son. And so it became a sort of, Katrine can't be happy for her father. And I'm, didn't know how to scream it any louder that he's leaving his son. It just angered me to no end.
So they were in her apartment and not in the house?
Yeah, for several months. I think there were like 3 months left on the contract. So he went with his new wife. We shall call her Mildred. He went with Mildred and they lived in the apartment and just left our youngest brother. And there, our other three brothers were living there and they were like 21, 18, and 17. So they were older. It wasn't completely alone, but he, our youngest brother was his responsibility. He should have been carrying him. He should have been made sure that his needs were met, but he just left him.
Okay. But then, so what made them decide that they should needed to move into the house? Is that you? That pushed them into that?
No, the contract ran out on the, her apartment. So she moved in.
Moved into the house.
And it was never a comfortable situation. First, you have three teenage boys. And she had a teenage daughter, too. And she was not a nice person. She just wasn't. And plus, she was got married to Dad. And I think, I never talked to her about it, but I think it started to dawn on her that Dad wasn't all there. That his faculties weren't all intact. So her habit in her life had been to move often. And so she decided it was time for them to move. So they decided to move to Idaho. Dad called it he was moving to the country of his birth. I kept trying to tell him it was a state, not a country. That he was moving to the country.
They went to Idaho and our youngest brother went with them. And he only lasted about 3 or 4 weeks up there.
He was miserable. They had him, his bedroom was in the laundry room. He didn't even have a bedroom. He had the laundry room.
Which was, if I'm not mistaken, part of it was dirt. The floor was
dirt. The basement was dirt, yeah.
The dirt basement.
Yeah. It was an old house.
Uh-huh.
So he was trying to save himself from a very difficult situation and found friends to live with. And they agreed to let him live with them. But they didn't realize that Dad would have nothing to do with Paul, because he never had anything to do with any of us. So it became kind of, I don't want to say ugly, because they were good, kind people, but they sent me a letter and said that we needed to find a new place for our younger brother to live. And he ended up moving with you.
Yes, I remember this was going on, hearing bits and pieces of how things weren't quite going so well for him anymore with this family that he was living with, and awkward situations, and he was a good kid, but he wasn't always doing things the way they wanted him to do it. And
well, and to say that meant he wasn't going to church every Sunday.
Oh, was that what it was? Essentially?
Yeah, but he, I mean, that's the worst he did.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, before Mom died, I had promised her, and I had promised him, and my wife had promised them both that we would take care of him after she was gone. And that was always nagging at me, thinking, you know, oh, well, I should be doing something to help, because here he is with Dad and his new wife, but I guess he's okay. But they're not acting like it's okay. And then he's living with this other family back in our old ward. That doesn't seem to be going well. But during all this time, I was also actually going through a divorce. By that time, our brother was sophomore in high school. And so we sent him a letter, and we called him, and we talked to him and convinced him to come and live with us. So, and we were just buying a nice big new house, and then we had plenty of room for him. And so he came to live with us for a couple of years until he graduated from high school, which was great. I was really glad that he did. I was glad that we were able to help him and that he found some sense of stability for those last couple of years of high school. And then before he went on his mission too, he was with us. And he remained fairly active in the church while he was there with us, even though clearly I wasn't anymore. But I'd take him to church sometimes and sit with him, and I'd try to, you know, get him involved in some of the things that went on in the ward. But it was hard for him, being the only one. But somehow he stuck with it, and then he ended up going on a mission. So
he's awesome.
Great. Yep, he's an awesome kid.
And then, so Dad marries this woman. They had a horrific car accident, and his wife is killed, and Dad is injured, but he survives. And that begins another stage in his life where, again, he's living on his own. He's without a wife. He's left everyone. He's by himself because he left all of his children. Communication with him is very sparse because he chooses to have it that way. And somehow he's able to convince another woman to marry him. And this lady, I actually believe that Dad and her would have been very happy together. But unfortunately, when he met her and married her, she was deep into Alzheimer's. And it was very apparent. And so it began another stage in his life where he was taking care of somebody when he had no ability to take care of another person. And they buy a house, and they live in this little house, and they have home health care. And come to find out that this home health care worker that worked there, I'm going to say her real name because I'm ticked off. Her name is Maria. It's hard to say what happens because we're dealing with the delusions of an old man. And so, coming from my dad's, I'll just give my dad's perspective. And it took a long time to figure this out because my dad wouldn't tell us the truth about anything. But Maria came and took care of them, and she always had a sad story. She had cancer. Her husband beat her. I mean, it went on and on. And Dad realized that she was one of his wives, and they began a sexual relationship. in there, I don't know what's delusion and what's real, but something was happening where she took advantage of Dad, and she took him to the bank. They took out a mortgage on his paid-off home. He bought her a car the day they took out the mortgage. And she proceeded to spend the next year or two spending all the money from the mortgage, and she also took out a couple of credit cards in his name, spent all that money. And in the end, he was left with nothing. His wife, who at this point couldn't even speak English, she was just too far gone. So eventually it comes out that she has spent all of the money from the mortgage, left them destitute. His wife is put into a nursing home, and he is put into a different nursing home.
Because and had been diagnosed with Parkinson's.
Yes, he has Parkinson's. And it was just ugly because this woman took full advantage of a mentally ill man, a woman that had Alzheimer's. And it was allowed not only by the bank, because they suspected something was fishy, but the credit cards, they didn't care either. So they lost everything. And Dad was put into a nursing home. And she died a couple weeks after that, actually. And it was just, I don't know what to say about it. It was just awful. It was terrible, ugly.
Terrible, awful experience.
And this is what can happen, though, when you have a man who's mentally ill, who removes himself from society and from family, and there was no protection there for him or for his wife. Now, time has passed a few years now since that incident, and Dad's, not only does he have Parkinson's, but he may have Alzheimer's as well, but definitely severe dementia by now. And the dementia has been interesting because it has removed any sort of screening process he had before where he would keep things secret and quiet. It's all out there for the world now. I mean, I took him to the museum, and he was introducing himself as the prophet of the church. And there were sister missionaries that he wanted to make a beeline for because he had some important business to talk with them. And I kind of wanted to see what would happen by letting him loose with the sister missionaries. But I kept him with me, and he was introducing me to his multiple wives that live in the nursing home. And he was also telling me there was a TV show on Full House. And he was telling me that Jason was a great thespian, and he was on TV. So he's actually quite happy in his delusional state right now in the nursing home. But what I want to say about all that and how it deals with Mormonism is that Mormonism didn't by any means cause his mental illness, but it definitely built a foundation where you believe you can have revelations. And so you believe that they're true. You believe they exist. You're told that you're special. So he believed he was special, and of course every person is, but he took it to a whole different level.
He was really special.
Yeah. And I just think that the bishops in this church, people are told to go to them for help. They don't have any background in any of this kind of condition. They can't help anyone, so it is completely irresponsible to tell family members who are suffering to go to a bishop for help, and there's nothing there for them to get. It's not right to send people to somewhere where there's not any resources. It's not fair to the church leaders, and it's definitely not fair to children who are looking for help. I think we're all victims in this. I think Dad never got the help he needed. We didn't even recognize he needed help. We were taught that it was Satan. It's just unfair that this organization has put so many people in this position.
And so would you say that is the point where you maybe started to doubt?
Oh, no. No, I never doubted.
Even at that point, you didn't
Oh,
die.
No. Yeah. No, there was no doubt. I just thought, basically what I just said, that the bishops don't know what they're doing. Uh-huh. There's no training for them.
Right.
And no, I never doubted.
Yeah, I would have things like pop up in my brain that I would just ignore. It was amazing how trained I was to ignore certain thoughts and just not give any time or attention to them at all. And, I was thinking about that term, cognitive dissonance, that I have never heard that term so much as when over the last few months that I've been listening to podcasts. I've been out of the church for a long time, but I just started listening to the podcasts, and that term comes up over and over and over and over and over again, because there's all those things that we just choose to ignore and not even consciously choose to ignore. Subconscious choice that we have to ignore this certain thought, to not even worry about it. And I think that's a lot of what happened with us and with Dad, is so many different times through over the years, these red flags would pop up, and at least I would just not give them any heed at all.
So with the things that happened with that evil woman, Maria, I became his power of attorney, and I go up and see him a few times a year. And I talk to him on the phone occasionally, and I had tried to tell my brothers that, you know, there's some stuff going on. And I would give examples of weird stuff that Dad would say and do. Like, there was one time where I was sitting on the bed, and Dad would say, "You're sitting on your mom." And I would move over. He's like, "You're still on her. Can't you feel her?" I'm like, "Well, no, Dad, I can't feel her." And he's like, "Well, you're still sitting on her, but it's okay. She likes to feel you." And I'm, you know, so I try to tell him that there's stuff going on here. So we drive up, all my brothers except for one, and we're all going to see Dad for the first time in years.
And we have some of our kids with us. Some of them did not come. I had one of my daughters, and then my 9-year-old, well, he was 8 then, I guess, 8-year-old son. And my daughter was, she would have been 19 at the time. And my husband was with us. And you had a couple of your kids.
I just had my youngest son.
And so, I mean, Katrine had warned us, and I was prepared. I was, you know, no stranger to the crazy. And so we get there, and we all walk in, big, huge group of us, which in itself I'm sure was totally overwhelming to him, this person who never sees anybody. He's sitting there all by himself at this dining room table eating a piece of pizza. And he looks up, and he's like, "Well, would you look at this? What a nice surprise." That was a good way to start the visit. That was good. And so I, you know, we all give him a hug, and I stoop down to at his level, so my head is level with his head, and start chatting a little bit. And he goes, "Would you like to see your mother?" "Yeah, I would love to see my mother." "Well, she's just in the room down there. We'll go see her in a little while." "Okay. Great." Then he looks at me really close, and he goes, "I know who you are." "Oh, who am I?" "You can fool me for 1 minute. I see that smoke coming out of your nose. I know who you are." And then this was over the course of a few hours, and he said different things to different people that were just, to me, really, really disturbing. Obviously, because it was my dad, and he's ill, and he's saying strange things and some scary things. But it was so much of it was because he brought bits and pieces from the past with him into his things that he said, that some of it I knew was true, and some of it I wasn't sure if it was true, but it could have been true. And then some of it was, gospel related, and some of it was just creepy. He said a lot of things to my daughter that were really not appropriate, saying things about, "Oh, what a beautiful girl you have there," You know, you should really enjoy that beautiful girl. She, you know, Shaivet, she's, I don't even remember all the specific words that he said, but they were just really creepy and inappropriate. And I didn't like that she heard all that. And when I came out as gay, a long time ago, he eventually, I think, came to terms with it pretty much, or at least outwardly he did. But then, like you said, this dementia kind of took away all of his filters, and so he started to say things to me like, "So, do you still like men then? Is that the way it's gonna be? What about your beautiful wife? What about her? So you just think you're gay then, huh? And so clearly he had like regressed in the way that he believed and thought about me.
And he kept glaring at your husband.
He did. Yeah. He was not super kind to him, which my husband was one of the kindest people that there is. And he tried very, very hard. He's always tried very hard to have a good relationship with our dad. And then he started, our dad started saying things about, you know, more about revelations and about, are you living the gospel principles? And he asked our other brother if he's fulfilling all of his obligations in the church and living the gospel. And then he started singing hymns, but they were like his own made up hymns.
Will you please sing it for us? You do such a good job.
Well, thank you. He would sing these hymns about himself. You could tell they were hymns, sort of, based on a hymn. But then they would be about himself and about his revelations and his relationship with God, and then about other people too. He'd bring in other people. So they would be like things like, "And I know that I know what I know. God is real. He is here, and he tells his prophets what to do. And you better be good, or you'll go to hell."
So creepy.
Yeah, really weird. And then, again, all based on stuff that he grew up with, though. And then he said so many things, and I couldn't possibly say all of them. And then he started speaking in tongues. He would, you weren't there. He was doing it in the car when I was driving.
Yeah, he told me about it.
Have you ever heard him speak in tongues?
No, but Dad is constantly talking under his breath. I mean, there's a constant dialogue with Dad, and I'll catch little bits and things of what he's saying. So I think I've heard it before, but didn't put it together.
Yeah. He would say, it sounded like this. It would be like, "Biddy biddy bop bop
wow." This is the best podcast ever.
I know. Very academic. And then he would like shift in and out of, he would be lucid for a little while, and then he'd go back into all of that.
What's interesting about that is we were taking pictures during this, and there is time where Dad would carry on a normal conversation with us, and then a split second later, he'd be somewhere else. And you can tell just looking at the photographs exactly where Dad's mind was. One picture, he's smiling, and you can tell he's like interacting with us. The next picture, he's just, you can tell by his facial expression, he's looking away. He's just gone. It's just so weird to have this visual comparison.
Yeah. Yeah, we took a lot of pictures during that time period. And then it was also funny to see, my face has always been an open book, but it was also funny to see my face as he was saying all this stuff. Because it was like I had never heard any of it before. Some of it I hadn't, actually. But.
And you came up to me and you like whispered to me, like, "I had no idea." I was like, "I tried to tell you."
I know. I was like, This is worse than I thought. This is harder than I imagined. It was terrible. It was very sad. But, you know, that, all of that happens, sort of thing happens all the time to people whose parents suffer from dementia and and Alzheimer's. You know, we heard a lot of the Alzheimer's talk from his wife, but this was different because it wasn't the first time we were hearing a lot of it. It was like, this is just like 20 years ago.
Well, and for me, it was like, oh, this is what's been in his mind all along.
Right.
Oh, he did hear voices. It was our own personal revelation of what had always been there.
Right. So, he was evaluated by a psychiatrist.
I admitted him into a psychiatric hospital for the first time.
Right, after he'd had a really bad...
Yeah, he had told... He in one of his nursing homes, he was becoming very difficult to take care of. Like, he wouldn't sleep, and he would try to escape the home all the time. And at one point, he told his care provider that she was soon going to be removed from this earth. And right. It was a little unsettling for her.
Right.
So that's when I had him admitted to a psychiatric hospital for the first time in his life and the first time he was evaluated. And he's on medication now. Where it just, he's controllable. Like before, when he went through that time with his care provider, she couldn't control him any longer. So now he still has these delusions, but he's controllable.
So he has never received any official diagnosis from anybody. And that was the first time that he had ever seen a mental health professional who wasn't really interested in his mental health that much. He was just another person coming from Medicare. Right. Yeah,
well, they just needed to take care of his physical surroundings, you know. He needed a place to live. So right. That was their goal.
Right. So no one's ever diagnosed him. We've both done a lot of reading. I've done a lot of reading, and it's been pretty clear to me that, in my professional opinion, that he is a paranoid schizophrenic.
I believe it too.
You know, and there's so many things that we haven't talked about. Because this would be like a 12-hour podcast that clearly show that he has been very, very paranoid over the years, and that he has heard things and seen things that are not there. And
yeah,
the church
was fuel for the fire.
Yep, and where it maybe should have been helpful to some of us somehow, in that respect, was not. Maybe that's expecting too much from the church, but.
It may be. And looking back, I'm not really mad at the church. I just feel that it's irresponsible to claim they can help people when they have no capability.
Right.
And the very least they could say is, I don't know what this is. It's too big for me. I can't help you. But instead they just keep telling you, oh, the bishop will help. It's not right to do that to people.
Right.
We have to call it a day. I wonder if anybody will ever listen to this. If you have, congratulations.
You made it clear to the end.
Thank you. We'll have Jason back and we'll have him tell more of his story because he has more to say, definitely about his personal Mormon story. Thank you for listening. You can also go to MormonExpression.com. And if you would like to tell your story and tell your Mormon expression, we'd love to have you on Voices. You can email me at voices@mormonexpression.com. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Katrine.
Bye.
Bye.